Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Stephanie Hepburn, author of Human Trafficking Around the World, Hidden in Plain Sight, and Michael Marshall, author of Gallant Creoles, A History of the Donaldsonville Cannoneers. It's a day for serious subjects. Stephanie Hepburn is what I would call a Renaissance woman. She's a lawyer and independent journalist. Her first book was Women's Roles and Statuses the World Over with co-author Rita Simon. Her new book is Human Trafficking Around the World, Hidden in Plain Sight. Stephanie lives here in New Orleans. Welcome to The Reading Life, Stephanie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, the beginnings of this book, and it was a long writing journey for you, take place in post-Katrina New Orleans and things you saw here. Describe that for us.
So I moved here in February 2006. And so, as you know, that wasn't that long after Hurricane Katrina. And it was interesting. So I came and I moved from New York City to New Orleans. So that in itself was a significant change post-Katrina New Orleans. And what I saw, it was, I think, my second day of living here. And I went on a devastation tour with my husband. And he took me around and we drove by mid-city and I noticed these tents and there were tent after tent after tent. And I started wondering, like, who's living in these tents? They seem to be workers and these are subhuman conditions. Turns out that they did have access to showers. I found this out later. And so I wondered who they were, what they were doing, if they were here just for labor purposes or if they were somehow displaced. And I never actually found out that much more about those individual persons, but it made me start thinking about workers in general in New Orleans at that time. So I started doing a little bit of research, and it turns out that there was a decent amount of human trafficking that was going on in New Orleans at that time. So not just worker exploitation, you hear a lot about worker exploitation, but this would rise to the level of human trafficking. And so there are at least 9 large cases that I know of that took place during that time.
Wow. And so here we are, years later. Now, one of the things this book illuminated for me personally were the complications in talking about these issues, like the way human trafficking victims are also confused with illegal immigrants, the difference between human smuggling and human trafficking, the problems of stateless persons, the way most people assume human trafficking is sexual trafficking, and economic, geographic things. So tell us why this is such a hard thing to investigate.
First of all, I think it's not just your average person that has misconceptions about human trafficking. It's also lawmakers, and so that adds a level of complication. When we talk about human trafficking, most people think of sex trafficking. That's usually what first comes to mind, and it's pretty understandable why that is. It's been much more prevalent in the media. Forced labor, on the other hand, we don't really hear that much about. I think actually now you're starting to hear more and more cases, but let's say 10 years ago, that's not what you were hearing about. So I think that's part of it. There's also, like you said, a conflation with smuggling. A lot of lawmakers confuse the two. So anybody who's crossing borders, they use the term trafficking. But the reality is that you don't have to have movement to have human trafficking. Somebody can be trafficked within a country, within a state, within an area. So that's another misconception. In terms of forced labor, the statistics or the estimates, I should say, right now, there are 20.9 people worldwide that are victims of human trafficking. And 78% of those persons are victims of forced labor. And 22 are victims of sex trafficking. Now, the important thing to recognize, and I think that what I've noticed is that when I say that, then people seem to want to shift the focus just to forced labor. To me, whether it's for forced labor, whether it's for sex, it's all forced labor. I mean, to me, that's all indentured servitude. So actually separating the two, to me, does not make sense. But I understand why it's been done historically. So I think it's important to recognize that just because I'm stating that 68 to 78, so the reason I say 68%, the additional 10% are those in forced labor, which is state-imposed forms of forced labor. So cumulatively, we're looking at 78% of victims are forced labor victims. But this is not to diminish what sex trafficking is by any means. I think it's important that that continues. I just want to expand the focus and understanding to make it understood that forced labor is very much a significant issue.
And what's so cruel about these stories is that these people enter into it with such hopes, with hope for work, hope for better jobs.
That's right. They do. And then, well, and there's also that's played upon. And one thing I noticed about New Orleans in general, when I started looking at these 9 cases and then I expanded to 24 other countries, what I noticed was that this pattern was the same. It didn't matter if it was in New Orleans. It didn't matter, you know, if it was in South Africa. The pattern was very much the same. So it's a formula that's very much working for traffickers. And they play upon people who are marginalized or for whatever reason want to find a way out. And so they create the situation where they offer jobs. And then what they do is they say, well, you have to pay a fee in order to secure the job. And these fees are amazing. I mean, we're looking at somewhere between $11,000 onward in terms of securing fees. And there's one case actually in the Gulf Coast region, the fee was $40,000. So when people hear that, they think, well, how in the world would somebody who doesn't have a job or is being paid marginally be able to afford that? Well, the reality is that they can't. So they end up taking loans, and these loans have astronomical interest rates. And then now you have a person who is $40,000 or $11,000 in debt. And that puts the employer or the trafficker in the power position. And so then the victims are taken from whatever country they were recruited from to the destination country, and their visas are taken away from them. Any sort of identifying documentation is taken away from them. They're often monitored by armed guards, so their movements are controlled. They also are charged fees for not producing enough or misbehaving. Even the use of tools, sometimes they're charged fees for housing. And so this pattern is the same over and over and over again, regardless of what country you look at.
So you looked at 24 countries in this book. Tell us about some of the leading countries in human trafficking, the ones who have the greatest problem.
Well, I think that's part of what also helps to break the misconception of about human trafficking. You know, when you think of first world countries, you're automatically going to think, well, they must have a better situation. And in some ways, in terms of the judicial systems, they do if the victim has been discovered. But I think it's important to recognize that the fact that they are first world countries make them very attractive. And so they're ideal destination countries. When you look at the scenario of human trafficking worldwide, there are different reasons why people end up in various countries. So, for instance, the United States, people end up here often because this is purported to be the land of opportunity, and in a lot of ways it is. So it makes it a good sell in terms of recruitment. And so that's why there's a great deal of human trafficking in the United States.
And we like to think we have the moral high ground in the world, and you can't read this book and think that.
Well, and I think it's important to recognize that I scrutinize every country that I look at. So it's not that the United States hasn't taken significant measures to try to address human trafficking, but my criticism is that it hasn't been sufficient. So we have a program called the H-2B visa, and this ended up being very much prominent in the Gulf Coast region post-Katrina and Rita. And it was a program that just simply wasn't monitored. And now there is proper regulation as of late 2008, but I don't know how many changes have occurred. That was a significant move to make those regulations. But I think that that's important to recognize, too, is that we have these visa programs, and not all of them are monitored properly.
One of the things that's so fascinating and moving about this book are the stories of individuals. You know, I think of that one woman named Elsa, who was trafficked from Brazil to Madrid, and said, after I lost my fear, I lost my hope, my dignity, I lost everything. So tell us about some of the stories that meant the most to you as you were researching this book.
Well, I think there's a traditional slavery case, and it's important to recognize under trafficking law, even though most countries have anti-slavery laws, that it also falls under trafficking law as well. And there was a case in Niger. And the reason that I'm very attracted to this case is it's a case of traditional slavery. So a lot of people don't realize that traditional slavery, or what's called hereditary slavery, still exists, and it does. What was so astonishing about this case is that she was called a Saduka, which is basically a fifth wife. And the fifth wife plays the role not only as slave, but also concubine. Obviously, none of this is by choice. And so from the time she was 12, she was raped and sexually harassed and had a very terrible existence. And she kept trying to run away, and then she'd be taken back. And at some point, she realized, well, this isn't right. Something's wrong here. And for somebody to have the ability, having been born into that situation, to have the ability to step back and recognize this isn't right, I mean, that's pretty phenomenal in itself. So, but then she tried through the court system in Niger to attain her freedom. And she did attain her freedom, but the slave owner sued her. And the judge amazingly found that she became the de facto wife. Once she was released from slavery, she became the de facto wife of his, which is amazing. It is not legally correct in Niger. The law does not follow that. But the judge was going by customary law. And it also shows you how strong and powerful customary law is. And in the end, she ended up suing Niger and winning, which is a really significant suit. And so when she talked about it later, she said this wasn't for herself as much as it was for her children. She had children, and she didn't want them to go through the same experience. She said, you're born free. Mm-hmm. You should have the experience of being free. So I think that that's part of it, too, is that you find such strength and spirit and inspiration in a lot of these victims.
Right. When you're writing this book, and you imagine a reader, who is the reader you're imagining?
My hope is that it's anybody. And so the way that I wrote it, I include statistical information in there, because I think in order for somebody to even get somewhat of an accurate scope of what's happening in a country, there need to be statistics to whatever degree and however accurate they can feasibly be, because I think it's probably just the tip of the iceberg, whatever numbers we're able to find. But I wove through each chapter stories, because I think that stories are more relatable for people, and they're able to see how this happens, not just read about, you know, factually, well, first this happens and this happens. In hearing about the stories, you're actually able to get a visual picture and relate to, maybe not feel that you yourself went through the experience, but to be able to read the narrative and to feel and to see the human tone, the human experience that the victims went through, and to be able to identify and examine it through that way. So for me, I included that not only to be comprehensive, but also because I felt that was the best way to access a broad spectrum of readers, whether they're anti-traffickers themselves or whether they're just a shop owner who just wants to learn a little bit more about what human trafficking is and how to identify it and what it means.
Right. And what do you think the average person can do?
I think talking is a big part of it, getting the conversation started, you know, going home and, you know, after hearing this, talking to your spouse and saying, oh, you know, I didn't really realize that that fell under the domain of human trafficking, and examining, well, where do our clothes come from? Where do our products come from? And kind of looking into those companies and seeing how much transparency there is. And we've heard a lot lately about U.S. companies or European companies that have factories in various other nations. Right. That's been a big topic lately. So that's going to help to increase transparency. And it's also going to help to increase our awareness that these things are happening in other countries and that we're wearing them, you know, and that the items and products that we're buying may in fact be human trafficking, or at least some level of exploitation may have occurred in the process. So I think thinking about that and then thinking going backwards, there's an app, it's called Free to Work, I think that's right, that you can download, and it actually tells you, it talks about transparency from farm to factory.
I thought that was great.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Well, every now and then you read a book and you think, this book should land on every lawmaker's desk, you know, and this is one of those books.
Thank you.
So thank you. We've been talking with Stephanie Hepburn, who's one of the authors of Human Trafficking Around the World, Hidden in Plain Sight. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Michael Marshall has done many things. He's been a New Orleans police detective, a high school history teacher, a United States Marine, and now he's the author of one of the most exhaustive Civil War books I've ever read. It's called Gallant Creoles, A History of the Donelsonville Cannoneers, and it is amazing. Welcome to The Reading Life, Mike.
Thank you very much.
So you worked on this book for 27 years. That's a long time.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
And it shows.
And the older you get, the faster time goes by. So now 27 years doesn't seem like it was that long.
Right. But one of the things that spurred your interest in this Donelsonville group is your family connection to them.
Yes, ma'am.
So tell us about that.
Well, back in 1985, my mother started doing genealogy and all, and she discovered that she was a Temple. Some say template, but the family says Temple. And she discovered that they were the number two family listed on La Bonne Porpoise that came to Louisiana in 1765. Cajuns, of course. One day, I stopped by to visit, and she said, "Did you know that your grandfather's grandfather surrendered at Appomattox with General Robert E. Lee's army?" And she said, "Not only that, but his brother did too." And I said, "Really?" And I'd always been a history buff. I grew up during the Civil War centennial. So it perked my interest, and I wanted to go read about their exploits and what happened to them and all. And when I started looking for reading material on them, it was hard to come by. I'd find bits and pieces and little things and no comprehensive story about them. Matter of fact, I even found later on in a Baton Rouge newspaper article that said that Pen and Press had neglected the Scanlon Command. So I knew there was a story there that needed to be told. And in the beginning, I just started collecting whatever I could find on them. And then it just started eventually evolving into a manuscript, and then that's find more. And every time I thought I'd unturn every rock of information, I'd find another rock with information behind it. So, and even to this day, I like to think I've uncovered every rock of information, but I know there's still some rocks out there with little tidbits.
Well, it's a pretty long book and pretty small time, so I don't know if there are many rocks left out there. Now, one of the things that you talked a little bit about in your introduction that I loved was how you grew up falling in love with history. You took vacations where you went to battlefields and Civil War sites.
Yes. Although my mother's pure Cajun, born along Bayou Lafourche, my dad's from Boston. So we used to take trips up north to go see his family. And then he would still visit some of his buddies from the Air Force. And one of them happened to live in Fredericksburg, Virginia, right on a battlefield. So I have memories as a 10-year-old walking his yard and just finding pieces of bullets and belt buckles and stuff. And to him, it was a curse because when he cut the grass, he'd always roll over a piece of metal or something, a rifle bit or whatever. So I remember those historic battlefields and the cannons and all that, and I've always had an interest in it. And two, it was in the early 1960s, and there were a lot of Civil War books and all coming out at the time, especially the ones with lots of drawings and pictures. Uh-huh. And I always loved those.
And you said when you were a Marine, you always had a book with you
about
the Civil War.
Yeah. One thing in the military, you do have a lot of time. It's always hurry up and wait, hurry up and wait. So I always made sure that when I hurry up and waited, that I had a book to read. And so I always made sure I had a little room in the pack, even if it was a small book, to take a history book with me.
I'm curious to know, because this is such a real chronicle of what soldiers' lives are like in the Civil War, these guys and the cannoneers. How did being a Marine give you a different outlook into their lives? Did it give you a kind of sympathy or?
No, it wasn't so much the part of being in the Marine Corps. Of course, I knew what the military life was like, but it was the reading of the history and all. And then being in the Marine Corps now, or then, it was like living history. Mm-hmm. Later on, when I became a history teacher for a couple of years, it was kind of funny that when you taught history and you got up to the 1960s and all that, I realized that I lived history.
Right.
And so it wasn't so much being in the Marine Corps, but just reading. Mm-hmm. It was the big thing and was the connection.
This has such a long history. You know, this group was in existence for 61 years, which is pretty amazing. And they began as kind of a municipal militia, right?
Right. I wouldn't even call them really a militia. I would call them more of a police force, a local police force. Mm-hmm. You could say militia, but also a fire department. And also, some of the things I came across, they were also known as a charitable association. So if somebody needed help, they put the can out and asked for coins to help certain people out.
And what sort of people got involved in the Donaldsonville group?
It was citizens of Donaldsonville. There were soldier citizens. It was the middle class citizens, the lady citizens, even the poor citizens. Everybody took part because you got to remember, too, they started in 1837, lived through the 1840s and 1850s. So it was a time where they didn't have TV. Books usually were hard to come by, but an interesting fact was Donaldsonville had its own bookstore for $3 a year. It was almost like a library, but you paid $3 a year. And the Rouges, who had it, would get their books from France and all.
I love that story.
And then the local newspaper, too, at the bottom of the front page was usually a continuing series of plays and stories, usually with a French, and they were all in French, too, but it was, had a French theme to it with a connection to Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about some of these guys. I was fascinated by Prosper Landry. I love the name first,
Jean-Jacques Renard Prosper Landry. Mm-hmm. And a very interesting guy. He was the grandson of one of the first Landrys in the Donaldsonville Ascension Parish area. Obviously very smart because they sent him off to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., where he got his education. I believe he graduated in 1847 or 48. And then from there, his family was wealthy enough. He went to 2 years in Europe to study and travel and, I guess, become a man of the world. Mm-hmm. And he was. But his personality was the kind where everybody, I think, who met him almost fell in love with him. And he just had to have been an engaging personality. Spoke fluent French and English, and was always beloved all the way till his death in 1907, mm-hmm. and was always a leading man of Ascension Parish and Donaldsonville, but never looked for the credit or the fame.
Yeah. Well, you could tell he was the kind of man who would win hearts and minds.
Yes.
You could really see that.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about their Civil War experience.
Well,
because you've got it practically day by day in this book.
I like to kind of compare them. Back in the Civil War, with the Union armies, the Medal of Honor had just been started during the Civil War and was issued for the first time during the Civil War. So the Union Army, for heroes and all, they bestowed the Medal of Honor on them, and we still do today to our heroes in the military for famous feats and all. But the Confederate Army during the war didn't have medals or anything. The only form of recognition was usually when your name was mentioned in a battle report and all. But the cannoneers during the different battles of Gettysburg and Fredericksburg and Petersburg, Manassas, there's a few instances where I have no doubt that if they were part of the Union Army, the Donaldsonville cannoneers, some of them would have received the Medal of Honor for the deeds that they did. Mm-hmm. And the only recognition that they got was a mention in a report, most of the time not even their name, just the Donaldsonville Creole Company.
Wow.
Because throughout the Confederate Army, they were known as the Creole Company. And Longstreet complimented them on the field of battle at Fredericksburg. Other generals had mentioned them in their reports, even though they weren't part of their organization. And at Fredericksburg, too, an especially heroic and brave thing that they did, the whole Confederate Army cheered them on the battlefield because they were in a position where everybody could see them and knew what they did.
Wow.
But as far as their other battle experiences, they took part in just about every major battle except for Chancellorsville, which because of a very hard winter, they had a lack of horses for Chancellorsville and hadn't received any yet. But every other battle they took part in, not only took part in the battle, but usually was part of the rear guard for Lee's army. Yeah. I almost thought of calling the unit itself Lee's rear guard, something to that effect, because it seemed like they always got stuck protecting as the army moved about.
And you are so good at ferreting out these details of what life was like then, the food, the illness, when you lost your horse, you were in deep trouble. I mean, all those sorts of things.
The little things always fascinated me. In researching the book and all, of course, you have the battlefields of today, Gettysburg and Antietam and all, and they're preserved, and you can get tour guides to take you along and show where the position and armies were and where great feats occurred. But the thing that fascinated me, and I guess going back to the part about being in the Marine Corps, was how did they get there and what did they eat? And so that fascinated me. And in researching it and all, I started tracing their paths and all. And the amazing part was that if you're going to visit Civil War battlefields, try to find the way the armies got there. And it's amazing that if you follow their routes today that the armies took in the different battles and all that, that a lot of it is still almost basically the way it was back then. Of course, the roads are asphalt and not dirt, and there's telephone wires up there. But a lot of the houses back then are still there in Virginia, and you can still picture it as they pictured it.
And they covered a lot of ground.
Yes.
That's what's amazing. I have to say, I love the way they named their guns, too.
Yes. That Don't ask me to pronounce them. I can read them, but I can barely pronounce them.
But it's very endearing. It's like, it, you know, in a weird way, it's just endearing. It shows how they were centered.
It wasn't unique to them, too. The famous Washington Artillery of New Orleans, they named their guns, too. So I think it was kind of a common practice back then. And I think we can even fast forward it to World War II and probably even to our Abrams tank today, where the guys in the tank or paint the name on their tank or something like that. So I think it's probably always been like that all the way back to the Greeks with their shields and their little special emblem painted on it.
And one of the great things about this book is that you give a brief biography of every member of the Cannoneers. That really is fascinating.
I think we can thank the Catholic Church for that. since most of them were Catholics. And so I had a pretty good head start on it with the birth records and death records marriage and children. But it's fascinating, too, is the newspaper obituaries. You can really glean a lot. Of course, you got to take some of it with a grain of salt. But the newspapers do have a lot of information.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It just really brings all these guys to life. And so I hope everybody will read it. We've been talking with Michael Marshall, who's the author of Gallant Creoles, The Donaldsonville Cannoneers. He'll discuss and sign this book Saturday, August 17th at 1 at Barnes & Noble in Metairie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. George Bishop signs Night of the Comet Tuesday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Gary Michael Smith discusses how to write a cookbook Tuesday, August 13th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Historian Maria Falco begins a 3-week class, The Politics and Art of the Renaissance, Wednesday, August 14th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Historian Jeff Anderson discusses hoodoo and voodoo in Black history, Thursday, August 15th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library. The Great Books Discussion Group discusses Saul Bellow's Seize the Day, Thursday, August 15th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library. Fantasy and thriller author Charles Gramlich discusses Twisting Your Plot to Keep Readers Hooked at the Meeting of SOLA, the South Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America. That's Saturday, August 17th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Richard Ford's Canada, Saturday, August 17th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Michael Marshall, discusses and signs Gallant Creoles, A History of the Donaldsonville Cannoneers, Saturday, August 17th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The Fiction Writers Group meets Mondays at 7 at East Bank Regional Library. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.